Live from New York, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. We're here to empower people, sharing positive insights on how to live a longer and healthier and happier life. Today, we're going to begin by looking at supplement combinations that lower Alzheimer's disease risk, as published in the Journal of Alzheimer's Disease. We'll also be looking at incense. It's very popular, but it can also be linked to cardiovascular death. And did you know that animal proteins have a special type of sugar? And now it's believed from the University of California San Diego School of Medicine that that animal-specific sugar may drive cancer risk in people who eat any form of red meat, and much more on health and nutrition. Then today is also a day of addressing many issues that are not talked about in the mainstream media. The Truth About Loneliness, an article by Dr. Billy Gordon, Psychology Today. The Zombie Apocalypse and the Politics of Artificial Scarcity. I think this you'll find extremely interesting, from Hampton Institute, Colin Jenkins. The idea that when you put money in a bank, it's no longer your money. You can take it out unless the bank goes through a crisis. And then when they do go through a crisis, which is inevitable, that's no longer your money. It's theirs. The Cyprus-style bank bail-ins to take deposits and pensions, yours, and it's a global banker's coup. The market oracle, Professor Ellen Brown, also warning bank deposits will soon no longer be considered money but paper investments, from the Economic Policy Journal. Also, from the State Budget Solutions, promises made, promises broken. This year alone, how much unfunded liabilities you have just at the state level? $4.7 trillion. And also, our spy agencies are working on a psychological profile for every human being in the United States. That's correct. Newly released documents by Edward Snowden show that the National Security Agency and other spy agencies are tracking people's psychological and lifestyle traits, such as your sexual preferences, extroversion versus introversion, whether you are a leader or a follower. They want to know everything about you. Why? Also, the UN report documents torture and police violence in the United States. And then my guest in the second part of our program to talk about corruption and failures of the National Vaccine Injury Compensation Program, or what's called the Vaccine Court, Wayne Rota. And he will be here to discuss that. So you see, we have a lot to share. Let's begin. We have a major article. It is an updated article. It's updated every month for about 30 years on sugar. And I update the articles in such a way that the references and the material could be cited in a court of law. So this shows you how bad sugar is. It's bad. But then we were surprised when we saw all these people who were meat eaters coming down with cancers at a very high rate. And you don't have this with healthy vegans at all. So the University of California at San Diego School of Medicine decided to do a study on this. And they wanted to find out about a specific type of sugar in red meat that may play a role in forming tumors in humans. The researchers wanted to understand why people who eat a lot of red meat, which is most Americans, are at a higher risk for certain cancers. The team first conducted a systematic survey of common foods and found that red meats, meaning beef, pork, and lamb, are rich in a sugar called NUE5GC. and that provides the primary sources of this sugar in the human diet. From previous studies, the researchers had found that NEU5GC can be absorbed into human tissues. And from those findings, the team hypothesized that eating red meat could therefore promote potentially cancer-forming inflammation in the body. And so that's what they came up with. So in a mouse model engineered to have a deficiency of this sugar, the scientists found that feeding the mice NEUG5C resulted in systemic inflammation, which was associated with a 500% increase in spontaneous tumor formations. Quote, this is from the principal investigator, Dr. Varick, distinguished professor of medicine, cellular molecular medicine. Until now, all of our evidence linking NEU5GC to cancer was circumstantial or indirectly predicted from somewhat artificial experimental setups. This is the first time we have directly shown that mimicking the exact situation in humans, feeding non-human NEU5GC and inducing anti-NEU5GC antibodies increases spontaneous cancer in mice. So, just keep in mind, and this was published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, that for all the people who've been eating red meat, this is one more of the piece of the puzzle as to why, along with cooking the meat and creating a known cancer-causing agent, heterocyclic amines, that you now have a greater instance of colorectal cancer, stomach cancer, brain cancer, prostate cancer, ovarian cancer, and breast cancer. Where I grew up, no one ever used incense. And it was when I was down in the West Village, when I first came to the city, listening to music that I could smell incense, and I thought it was pretty cool. Well, today, when you travel throughout many parts of the world, it's absolutely common in households in the Middle East and the Far East to smell incense. According to Prevent Disease, even though incense is commonly used, mainly for religious and ritual purposes, in some of the most populated nations of the world, few studies have ever examined incense burning as a potential health threat. Investigators have found a link between long-term incense use and increased cardiovascular death. And just about any smoke is harmful to our lungs if it's inhaled. Incense burns 400% more particulate matter than cigarette smoke. Now, we know that incense is very, very popular in Asian countries. It's common for the Buddhism and Taoism religions to burn incense daily. The air pollution in and around various temples has been documented to be harmful to your health. The study used data from the Singapore Chinese Health Study, which enrolled 63,000 adults and over a period of 5 years. And the authors identified cardiovascular deaths on the association with how much they were exposed to of the incense. Now, we know that previous studies have reported concentrations of volatile organic compounds and particulate matter in incense emissions similar to those in cigarette smoke. And other studies have shown that long-term exposure to incense smoke increased blood vessel inflammation and affected blood flow. And that's not good. Incense is dangerous to health, according to researchers at Gillings School of Global Public Health, University of North Carolina. Quote, hazard assessment of United Arab Emirates incense smoke, an article appearing in Science of Total Environment. So what's in incense? Well, the typical composition of stick incense consists of 21% by weight of herbal and wood powder, 35% of fragrance material, 11% of adhesive powder, and 33% of bamboo stick. Now, like any cigarette smoke and wood smoke, incense smoke contains particulate matter and gas products such as carbon monoxide and carbon dioxide and sulfur dioxide and other organic compounds like benzene, toluene, and aldehydes, polycystic aromatic hydrocarbons, all of them are bad. And a study published in the Bulletin of Environmental Contamination and Toxicology indicates that burning incense can expose people to dangerous levels of cancer-causing chemicals. So that's what's in it, and therefore I suggest don't use it because it's a form of indoor air pollution. And when people start to use it, they can use a lot of it, and they use it on a regular basis. All the people who I counsel who have brain imbalances, mainly Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, ALS, dementia, which is epidemic right now, I'm seeing so many people in their 40s and 50s who have memory loss leading into dementia. And the problem is, and this is so frustrating for people, people will put something down. They'll put their keys or a telephone, cell telephone, or a purse, and then they'll forget they put it there. And now they're looking for it, and they don't find it, and then they start blaming people who have stolen it. Well, people haven't stolen it. They just forgot where they put it. And then people don't remember. And then they don't remember how many times they've forgotten stuff. In one particular instance, a man told me that his mother had forgotten at least 1,000 times, things that later turned up. And as if there is no sense of contrition, they just do it all over again. So that's when you know that you're heading into dementia or in dementia. And it shouldn't be taken lightly because it can be devastating, even though the long-term memory can still be all right. And that's also true with Alzheimer's. Well, an article published in the Journal of Alzheimer's Disease reports positive results for a combination of three nutrients in the prevention of Alzheimer's disease. And it was called the TONE Project, which enrolled men and women in this TONE town, Japan. And they received three different nutritional supplements, including DHA from fish oil, ginkgo biloba, and not a lot of ginkgo biloba, it was around 240 milligrams, and lycopene, 84 milligrams of lycopene from tomatoes. And they use these for 3 years on a daily basis. And neuropsychological testing was administered at the beginning of the study, and at the first and second follow-up visits, and over the whole time, they found there was a 31% lower adjusted risk of Alzheimer's in comparison to no supplements. That's a huge difference. That's a third less likely to develop Alzheimer's for three inexpensive, easy-to-take, non-toxic supplements. That's a no-brainer. Quote, to our knowledge, this is the first intervention study to report the positive effects of a combination of supplements on Alzheimer's disease prevention. No, it's not. I did the first one, doing one right now with really positive results, but that's all right. Quote, although supplementation of multiple nutrients rather than a single nutrient may hold better promise to tackle this complicated disease. They are right there. So I'm glad that they did this. So for anyone with memory loss of any kind, again, DHA, that's your fish oil, or you can get it from flaxseed oil, ginkgo biloba, and lycopene, L-Y-C-O-P-E-N-E. Now, I would do a different amount. I would do 400 milligrams of DHA. I would do 300 milligrams of ginkgo, 100 in the morning, 100 in the afternoon, 100 in the early evening. And I would do 100 milligrams of lycopene, 50 in the morning, 50 in the afternoon. So I'd break it up a little differently. Now, we have a lot of people in our society who take aspirin each day. Medicine has suggested that an aspirin a day keeps a stroke away, and indeed, it will. They are correct. It will act as a natural blood thinner. And to those people who benefit from that, that is good. However, aspirin also causes bleeding Over 20,000 people die a year from aspirin bleeding alone. And virtually every aspirin you take can destroy folic acid, vitamin C, B6, and B12. Those four nutrients are essential in order to keep your homocysteine level down. When you have an elevated homocysteine level, you're more susceptible to heart attacks. Therefore, while you lessen your likelihood of a stroke, you're increasing your risk of a heart attack. It makes no sense at all. Unless you're a doctor, then it makes complete sense. That's like using chemotherapy, knowing full well that it's not going to work. And you should know full well because there are no studies proving that there's a really substantial quality of life improvement or length of life improvement. But because everyone is using it and therefore it is considered the scientific standard, the logic is if I'm using scientifically standardized medicine, I'm doing the right medicine. No, your logic is right as far as honoring a particular belief, but then you're killing the patient. And that's a part of our contradiction in life. Recently, someone sent me an email. They're living a miserable life with a dead-end low-level job that is one of those, just imagine a room with, 100 people in little tiny cubicles working at something that has nothing to do with anything except keeping a foundation going forward. So it's really about supporting the foundation rather than that tiny percentage of 2 to 3 to 5% that actually helps the public. And miserable at every level, but did not want to disappoint people by taking another job. More interested in what people think of this person rather than what this person thinks of living an authentic life. It's hard to imagine that kind of logic. It's so twisted. And yet that's what people do. Because if the average person honored their real life, you wouldn't be in most of your relationships. You wouldn't be hanging out with the people you hang out. You wouldn't be living such a little narrow life. You'd be living a far more expanded life, engaged in a lot more. But that's the power of conditioning. So when people are told, take your aspirin, doctors take it, then patients take it, then everyone takes it, and everyone believes it's real. It's good. It's not. Again, it's just part of this systematic misinformation. Aspirin is killing people. Is it natural? Yeah, it's natural in its beginning, white willow bark, but then it's how it's processed. Okay, so what if we wanted the benefit of thinning the blood, helping prevent heart attack and stroke? What other options are there if we choose another option? Well, there's a very good study that was published over, it was a 15-year study, by the way, published in the peer-reviewed journal Heart. They studied 27,939 healthy female doctors. It was a randomized study. The average age of the women was 54. They were given 100 milligrams of aspirin a day or a placebo. And they found the risk of gastrointestinal bleeding outweighed the benefit of the intervention for colorectal cancer and cardiovascular disease. So there's a huge study showing it does not work. It kills people. But you didn't have any change. So even though the evidence is there to show that what you're doing is not working and is counterproductive and harmful, mindsets don't change easily. Now, keep in mind that the entire non-steroidal anti-inflammatory group of over-the-counter drugs are major killers. Remember Merck's Vioxx? 88 to 140,000 people ended up with heart attacks and strokes. About 65,000 died. Tylenol is profoundly toxic to the liver. So what can we do? Well, here's something simple. I'll make it real simple. I could say garlic, yes, that will do it. Vitamin C will do it. Quercetin will do it. Coenzyme Q will do it. Vitamin E will do it. I'm going to give you something different. Something that's also made from bark. White willow bark is aspirin. Pine bark. And you have pycnogenol. Pyc, P-Y-C, Nog, N-O-G-N-O-L, E-N-O-L, pycnogenol. It beats aspirin hands down. First of all, it's a very quality, all-natural antioxidant. It's extracted from the French maritime pine bark. We've known about this for almost 40 years. It is good for dozens of health conditions. And there was a good article published in the peer-reviewed journal Thrombotic Research that found that pycnogenol was superior to low-dose aspirin at inhibiting smoking-induced clotting. There was no side effect. From the article, quote, the effects of bioflavonoid mixture, pycnogenol, were assessed on platelet function in human cigarette smoking increased heart rate and blood pressure. These increases were not influenced by oral consumption of pycnogenol or aspirin just before smoking. However, increased platelet reactivity yielding aggregation 2 hours after smoking was prevented by 100 milligrams of pycnogenol in heavy smokers. So, thus, smoking-induced enhanced platelet aggregation, there's your heart attack if you smoke, or stroke, was inhibited. So, it's better than aspirin. It will help you reduce blood pressure. It will thin your blood. It turns off inflammation. It's inexpensive and completely non-toxic. I'm Gary Nall. That's the latest on health and healing. Now just a couple of issues before we take a break. And I'm going to ask for some feedback on this in our talkback segment. And our number to call in on this, and just on this, please, is... I'll give that number to you in just a second here. I want to share some insights that I think are relevant. Because what are we living with today? We're living with dystopian narratives. They've been alluring and thought-provoking in entertainment, especially for those who take an interest in studying social and political structures, as this audience does. From classics like 1984 and Brave New World to The Hunger Games, these stories play upon our fears while simultaneously serving as warning signs for the future. Now, their attractiveness within American society is not surprising. According to Colin Jenkins, our lives are driven by fear. I believe that's correct for most people. Fear leads us to spend and consume. Fear leads us to withdrawal from our communities. Fear leads us to apathy regarding our own social and political processes. Let me just give an example. For nearly a year, I invited any independent candidate on the program, and I asked them, don't tell us more than yes or no. And I gave them 40 conditions. Would you close down all the military bases around the world? Yes or no? Every one of them said yes. Would you abolish the Federal Reserve, the complete corruptness of that institution and its 12-member banks and the major stockholders who are profiting by the tens of billions of dollars a year from that? Yes. Would you close down the IRS and make a flat tax? Yes. Would you have a single-payer health insurance? Yes. Across the board. So virtually on every important indice, they were all in agreement. And yet together, Jill Stein, Rocky Anderson, Gary Johnson, Dennis Kucinich, Ron Paul, together they couldn't get 4% of the vote. That, I believe, is based upon fear. Fear is conditioned as much as it is natural. The ruling class handbook, Machiavellian's The Prince, made it clear. What did Machiavelli say? Since love and fear can hardly exist together, if we must choose between them, it is far safer to be feared than loved. The idea of apocalypse is a central tenet of human society. We've been taught about Armageddon, Kali Yuga, Judgment Day, Wan Adin, nuclear holocaust, the end of times, the four horsemen, the sermon of the seven sons. Hierarchical societal arrangements leaves us feeling powerless. Exploitive systems like capitalism leaves us feeling hopeless or wanting desperately to be a part of it and to benefit from it. And the widespread deployment of fear ultimately keeps us in our place and out of the business of those who own our worlds. The last half century has brought us the zombie apocalypse, a fictional world where the human race has largely been transformed into a brainless, subhuman horde of flesh eaters, with only a few random survivors left to carve out any semblance of life they can find in a barren landscape. Now, the emergence and immense popularity of the TV show The Walking Dead is the latest and perhaps most influential piece in a long line of narratives centered within themes of survival, human interactions, and scarcity. I'm sure many of you at some point have come across one of the cable shows of the survivalists, and it shows people who more or less load up with ammunition, get a bunker someplace, and they show them as being almost imbecilic and absurdist versus talking with people about where are the best places to live, where are there places most likely to be supportable and sustainable, where are communities of like-minded people gathering, where they can still maintain their sense of self and autonomy and continue to live their own life but share some things in common in a mutually supportive environment. That's also survivalist. But we don't focus on that, because if we did, a lot of people would say, well, that's reasonable. Is it better to be prepared if there is some form of major disaster than not to be prepared? And the answer is, it's more reasonable. But if you only show someone that seems so extreme, then you think, well, I don't want to be a part of that. And hence, we end up with this whole idea that we shouldn't pay attention to any of this. Behind all political battles and social critiques and theoretical inquiries lies the most fundamental question. When left to our own accord, how will we interact with one another? And how one answers this question usually goes a long way to know one's perceived position on the world and how issues are viewed and opinions are formed. To our dismay, potential answers are typically presented in dualities. Are we good or evil? Competitive or cooperative? Generous or greedy? Violent or peaceful? And life doesn't work that way. At any given moment, we can be our opposite. It's always present. It's always there. There is no fundamental objective evil. There is only good, spiritual enlightenment, to which our conditioning and our lack of spiritual discipline takes us in measured steps away from that sense of looking at life by love. Do you realize what kind of solutions we would have if we looked through the lens of love? If we look through the lens of love, and if you were rich, you'd want to share what you have to help others who are not. You'd find ways to use that money to enhance their well-being, to give them opportunities. You wouldn't want to conduct war. You wouldn't look at another person of a different ethnicity or race or age or sexual orientation as being beneath you, but rather equal to you. You would respect their differences. That's through the lens of love. So evil doesn't exist as a separate created entity. It is merely a conditioned response from taking us away from the enlightened place we were all born. No baby is ever born a racist. And then one day we wake up and all of our perceptions are based upon malformed conditioned responses. A common theme among religion has been that human beings are born into sin. That's nonsense. That's stupid. And heavily influenced by so-called evil forces. Well, that's also stupid. Any given person at any given time can do something that is perceived as evil or perceived as good, caring, and loving. We have the opportunity to do both. It's the sense of our character and our moral balance that determines which of the options presented will we take advantage of. One who embraces this theme will tend to have less faith in humanity than one who does not. For if we really are engaging in a daily struggle to resist the powers of evil, it's reasonable to assume that evil will take hold of many. How can we trust anyone who at a moment's notice could potentially lose the ability to act on their own conscience. The common theme of our dominant economic system, capitalism, is that human beings are inherently competitive and self-centered. When combined, it's easy to see how such ideologies may create intensely authoritative and hierarchical systems. After all, people are influenced by strong and its opposite metaphorical and metaphysical forces, while also being drawn towards callous self-interest, certainly cannot be trusted with free will. This lesson is drilled deep into our psyches with each episode of The Walking Dead, where the potential threat of flesh-eating zombie hordes becomes an afterthought to the clear and present danger of evil humans who are out to get one another. Whether it's a sadistic governor charming an entire town with violent gladiator events, an outlaw gang with the obligatory pedophile, or a pack of hipster cannibals salivating at the thought of eating their next visitor, the intended theme is clear. Human beings are not capable of coexisting, even in a world where they rarely interact. That's what we've been told. But is it accurate? Are we really drawn towards conflict? Must we compete with one another to survive? Is it appropriate to apply Darwin's evolutionary theories to a social sense where the fit are meant to gain wealth and power over the weak? Or are we? Are we more inclined to mimic most other species on Earth, which have been observed over the course of centuries to exhibit mutual aid and mutual support carried out to an extent which challenges all of our conditioning to the contrary? There is ample evidence that caring about others is part of our mammalian heritage, and humans take this ability to a high level. Helping other people seems to be our default approach in the sense that we're more likely to do it when we don't have time to think a situation through before acting. After a conflict, we and other primates, including our famously aggressive relatives, the chimpanzees, have many ways to reconcile and repair relationships. Studies have shown that in the first year of life, infants exhibit empathy towards others in distress. Evolutionary anthropologist Michael Tomasello put it, he said, the concept of cooperation as an evolutionary imperative to the test with very young children to see if it holds for our nature and not just our nurture. Drop something in front of a 2-year-old, he finds, and she is likely to pick it up for you. This is not just learned behavior, he argues. Young children are naturally cooperative. So, if we are truly inclined to cooperate with one another, why is there so much division and turmoil in the world? The answer to this question may be found by assessing not only the mechanisms of capitalism, but more importantly, in the creation of artificial scarcity as a means of maintaining hierarchies. What do I mean by that? It's no secret that capitalism thrives off exploitation. It needs a large majority of people to be completely reliant on their labor power. It needs private property to be accessible to only a few so that they may utilize it as a social relationship where the rented majority can labor and create value. It needs capital to be accessible to only a few so that they may regenerate and reinvest said capital in a perpetual manner. And it needs a considerable population of the impoverished and unemployed, a reservoir army of labor, in order to create a demand for labor and thus make such exploitative positions competitive to those who need to partake in them to merely survive. It needs these things in order to stay intact, something that is desirable to 85 richest people in the world who own more than half of the world's entire population. But wealth accumulation through alienation and exploitation is not enough in itself. The system also needs to create scarcity where it does not already exist. And that is dangerous. Since capitalism is based upon buying and selling of commodities, its lifeblood is production. And since production is a capitalist system, is not based on need, but rather on demand. It has a tendency to produce more than it can sell. This is called overproduction. Overproduction, according to Michael Roberts, is when capitalists produce too much compared to demand for these services. Suddenly, capitalists build up stocks of things they cannot sell. They have factories with too much capacity compared to demand, and they have too many workers than they need. So they close down plants, slash the workforce, and even liquidate the whole business. That is capitalist crisis. Maintaining scarcity is also necessary for wealth enhancement. It is not enough that accumulation flows to a very small section of the population, but more so that a considerable portion of the population is faced with the inherent struggles related to an inaccessibility. For example, if millions of people are unable to access basic needs such as food, clothing, shelter, and health care, the commodification of those needs becomes all the more effective. On the flip side, the mere presence of accessibility or wealth, which is enjoyed by the elite, becomes all the more valuable because it is highly sought after. In this sense, it is not the accumulation of personal wealth that creates advantageous positions on the socioeconomic ladder. It's the impoverishment of the majority. Allowing human beings access to basic necessities would essentially destroy the allure and thence the power of wealth and the coercive nature of forced participation. This effect is maintained through artificial scarcity, the coordinated withholding of basic needs from the majority. These measures also seek to create a predatory landscape, something akin to a post-apocalyptic zombie-filled world where manufactured scarcity pits poor against poor and worker against worker, all the while pulling attention away from the zombie threat. In conclusion, a crucial part of this process is commodification. The transformation of goods and services, as well as ideas or other entities that normally may not be considered goods or into commodities, that can be bought, sold, used, and discarded. The most important transformation is that of the working class majority who, without the means to sustain on their own, are left with a choice of either A, laboring to create wealth for a small minority and accepting whatever wages are provided, or starving. As socioeconomic guardians of scarcity, Philip Richland says, quote, when society deprives any community or individual of the necessities of life, there's a form of violence happening. When society commodifies the bare necessities of life, they are commodifying human beings whose labor can be bought and sold. Underneath the pseudo-philosophical rationalizations for capitalism is a defense of wage slavery. For if your labor is for sale, then you are also for sale. Are we all for sale? In the hopes of acquiring a wage that allows us to eat, sleep, and feed our families? In the United States, 46 million people are living in poverty that is completely dire. 2.5 million have defaulted on their student loans. 49 million suffer from food insecurity, have lost hope. 3.5 million homeless are mocked by 18 million vacant homes, and 22 million who are unemployed or underemployed have been deemed unfit commodities and relegated to the reserve army of labor. The control aspect of the commodification of labor comes in its dehumanizing effect, an effect that was commonly recognized among 18th and 19th century thinkers. One of those thinkers, Wilhelm von Humboldt, when referring to the role of wage labor, explained, as whatever does not spring from a man's free choice or is only the result of instruction and guidance does not enter into his very nature. He does not perform it with truly human energies, but merely with mechanical exactness, suggesting that we may admire what he, the laborer, does, but we despise what he is because he is essentially not human. The worker, in her, his role in the capital label relationship, exists in a position of constant degradation and degeneration. This is essentially true with the onset of mass production lines and division of labor, both of which are inevitable elements within our system. As the division of labor increases, labor is simplified. In this role, workers are firmly placed in the positions of control within a highly authoritative and hierarchical system. Dystopian narratives are no longer fiction. From birth, we are corralled into a system that scoffs at free will, stymies our creative and productive capacities, and leaves us little room to carve our own paths. The constructs directed from above are designed to strip us of our inclination to care and cooperate and make us accept the need to step over one another to get ahead. Think of Black Fridays. This is not our nature. Whether we're talking about Kropotkin's studies in the wild, or Tomasello's experiences with children, observable evidence tells us we've been duped. Another world is not just possible, it is inevitable if we are to exist in the long term. In post-scarcity world, we must learn to cooperate. Your thoughts, 888-874-4888. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. Nice to have you with us, everyone. I'm Gary Nall. Now, some really good news before we go to our guest who's standing by in Minnesota. Corruption and the failures of the National Vaccine Injury Compensation Program, or what's called the Vaccine Court. Wayne Rhoda, he's co-founder of the Vaccine Safety Council of Minnesota and the Autism Advocacy Coalition of Minnesota. He is also a national advisory member of the Health Choice. Wayne has two sons, age 17, Nicholas and Austin. Nicholas was vaccine injured at 13 months by the MMR vaccine and later diagnosed with regressive autism. He has advocated extensively in Minnesota, Oklahoma, nationally for autism health insurance reform, vaccine choice, safety and research. And he's the author of the recent book, The Vaccine Court. We'll go to him in a moment. But a year ago, I decided to pull our Coco Magic Bar, which was, in many people's thoughts, the best nutrition bar in the world, and to make it better. Now, I realize sometimes when I do this by taking a product that's already considered the best out, it's the way my brain thinks. I come up with ideas, and I want to make it better, and I have. And as of today, just today, Coco Magic Bars has landed in our office in New York City and at 83rd and Broadway, and in the health food store at 89th and Broadway. And it is new, and it is better than anything that I know of out there, even better priced. What have I done? Well, first of all, I had too many ingredients in the first bar, and I found that I wanted more milligrams of the best items, so I gave a whole lot more of what makes a particular food unique and special and powerful in the body. And one of the things I realized we're missing are the really important fatty acids. So I start off, my number one ingredient is organic almond butter. And then chicory root fiber. And then organic rice protein. There's a lot of protein in this, by the way, as much as almost two eggs. And organic clove honey. None of this nonsense low-grade honey, the best of the best. And then the cherries, which are one of nature's most perfect foods. And then, of course, the organic cocoa and the best, the highest quality cocoa. And then the best nut of all, according to a study just out last week, organic walnuts. And then organic coconut and organic sesame seeds. And then I have a blend of green tea, spirulina, and chlorella, topped off with some stevia and Himalayan sea salt, and that's it. Now, this is, in my opinion, now the finest nutrition bar in the world. I will compare it to any one of the thousands out there. It took us 13 taste tests to get it perfect, where it satisfied everyone that this was the best. The mouthfeel, the aftertaste, the chewiness. It's a larger bar, and it's the Coco Magic Bar is back better than ever. So everything I hoped that would happen has happened, and we now have it. I only have, I think, 300 boxes on the first, and it's made in the United States, by the way. And so we just got the shipment today. So if you'd like to, and it's 12 to a box. Before it was 10 to a box. It's 12 to a box. The Coco Magic Bar. Many people use this when they're hungry, and this gives you high fiber, high protein, high-quality protein. I think there's 11 grams of complete vegetable protein. It is non-GMO. It is vegan. And as you saw, all those organic ingredients. And it is great priced. So give a call if you'd like to order it. Here's the number, at least until we're out of stock. It'll take us about 3 weeks to get more back in because we make them in small batches, so they're always fresh. Coco Magic Bar, back in stock, first time in a year. Call 877-627-5065, 877-627-5065. Or you can drop by and you buy it by the box, 12 to a box. All right? 877-627-5065. Coco Magic Bars, back and better than ever. Also, we're going to be moving our corporate headquarters in the next 45 days. We're looking for some people who would like to help us pack. We got a lot of packing to do. I've donated a lot of stuff to our sister station, WBAI. And I'm also looking for someone who I'm willing to give a year's worth of green stuff or red stuff to drive a truck south to Florida of things that we're going to store. So call 646-926-5422, 646-926-5422 if you'd like to donate your time, or if you are a driver and can drive a truck, then my gift to you is and I'd fly you back. So you drive down and fly back, and then you'd have a year's worth of a case of either green stuff or red stuff. Let's go out to Minnesota now and say hello to Wayne Rhoda. Nice to have you with us today, Wayne.
Well, thank you very much for having me on your program.
70 years ago, there were some terrible high-risk vaccines that came on the market, particularly the cellular pertussis and the Salk polio vaccines. Today, almost all pro-vaccine advocates acknowledge these were dangerous. And because the large numbers of damaged individuals from these vaccines and the large sums vaccine makers had to pay out for damages, many pharmaceutical companies dropped their vaccine development departments. But by the end of the 1970s, early 80s, there were only a small handful of companies still in the vaccine business. So pursuing vaccine science became too high a liability. So then President Ronald Reagan passed the Vaccine Compensation Act and the National Vaccine Injury Compensation Program. And the rest is history, with more vaccine-injured children and now increasingly younger and older adults than ever before are injured. And no one, not a single person or corporation, is ever held accountable. So please first give us an overview of what the National Vaccine Injury Compensation Program was originally attempted to do when the Vaccine Injury Act was passed by Congress in 1986. And second, why doesn't the national American public really know anything about the program?
Well, you said it very well in regards to the circumstances that built up to the program. Is that Congress was lobbied very hard by the pharmaceutical industry, stating that a few of the manufacturers were going to go out of business, basically because of the horrible outcomes of the DPT, which was killing a lot of children and maiming and injuring thousands of children. And this was, you know, the 70s and early 80s. That was a big problem. And actually what drove the issue was the insurance companies were terminating their liability coverage with these pharmaceutical companies. They decided they're no longer going to provide liability insurance. The pharmaceutical companies then came and said they started reducing output. Some of them actually stopped production of the DPT. And thus, that's when Congress basically had to do something. But it was in 1976 when a lot of people will remember this, what I call the swine flu fiasco, and I wrote about this in my book, is the CDC basically took over the vaccination program in the United States, and through a forced mandatory vaccination program for all the adults, it was our first attempt as a nation to vaccinate people and have the government reimbursed for injuries. That program, it was quickly halted after many, many people. And up here in Minnesota, there was quite a few folks that developed the Guillain-Barré syndrome and other injuries. That was kind of like the older child to what became the National Vaccine Injury Compensation Program. And that was passed in 1986. Actually, President Reagan, when signed it, did not want to sign it. He did not believe the federal government should be involved in compensating those who were injured. But he was convinced by his vice president at the time, George H. Bush, and a few others in his cabinet to sign it. And it established the program and started in 1988. And it was basically focused on those 6, 7, and 8 types of childhood vaccines. That's where the primary focus was. The problem that we had is that it was doing its job in the early 90s. It was compensating those who were injured or who have died. They were compensating the estates of those who had died. But in 1995, there was a dramatic shift. And that's where the Secretary of HHS at the time was Donna Shalala under the Bill Clinton administration. She cherry-picked the IOM report and removed residual seizure disorder as a known injury for the DPT vaccine. However, she left in the same injury for the MMR. So we know it was kind of like a cherry picking because the IOM report had the same conclusion for both the MMR and the DPT that they did not know enough about it and warranted further study. But she decided she had the authority to do so and remove residual seizure disorder. That right there, according to even Barbara Lowe Fisher, was the major change point in the whole program. And it took hundreds of petitions and moved them from what we call on-table injuries to off-table injuries. And now they had to go in and find medical experts and find established research, in which there really was none because no one was studying these effects that well. That was, in essence, what was highlighted in the IOM report.
Okay, Wayne, I don't want to get too tied up into the minutiae of this. I want you to paint with a little broader stroke here. Last month, the Government Accountability Office released a report showing serious problems with the Vaccine Injury Compensation Program and how it was not, in fact, helping vaccine-injured people. That's the bottom line, particularly children.
Right.
What else did the GOA uncover? Please make it succinct.
Well, the GOA report basically concentrated on a couple things. One, it was a lack of public awareness. That was their big highlight. They talked a little bit about some other issues regarding the length of time it took to adjudicate or what we call litigate these petitions out. But the main focus was the lack of public awareness. Now, when the act was passed, the secretary is mandated by Congress through that act to have what we call a reasonable promotion of the program. Now, there's been several discussions within the administration of the vaccine court. They were several people were very concerned that if they do have an open discussion with the general public about this program and the availability for those who were injured to file claims for compensation, it would scare people away from vaccinating. There's been several attempts prior, and most of those have been curtailed. So it only, basically, it's been printing out little brochures, handing them out at medical conferences. The GAO report that came out in November was basically telling the Congress that there's a lack of public awareness. The last time there was a GAO report was almost 15 years prior to that, and it basically said, these petitions are taking too long to adjudicate. They are doing that. They're actually improving. The program is actually improving, making it faster to get from beginning to the end to conclusion. The problem is we have now shifted away from childhood vaccination. It's almost exclusively about adult vaccines, the flu shot.
Well, it's been politicized. What we need to do is we need to make it an issue. I've noticed on various charts for vaccine injury settlement by the vaccine court that it takes years, which it should take weeks, for a case to be finalized and approved. And during all those years, the families are picking up the exorbitant medical costs for disabled children. Mm-hmm. And with respect to the vaccine court itself and how claims are processed and determined, they're nothing but faults. I see a completely corrupt system. I believe that we should have all of the different vaccine advocacy groups in this country ask their legislators to have this court reformed so it serves all people who are injured. For example, with vaccines like Gardasil on the market, which there is no real need, nor has it yet be scientifically proven effective for any notable duration. Vaccine makers have no incentive to produce a true safety and effective vaccines. And so if the vaccines are not safe and effective, proven, and if you start off with the idea that you have to prove that your injury came from a vaccine, and it's hard enough to do for the average lay person who has no background in science, and then you have a court that they have no appeal to from their verdict, and you can wait years, you could go bankrupt in the process. So everything about this entire system has been compromised. What is your solution?
Well, I presented about 15 or 16 different areas for reforming the program. There's been a lot of people that want to get rid of the program. There's just no way that's going to happen. There's not enough political capital, if you will, in Congress to go back to what it was prior to 1986. To reform it, to make it easier and just to be equitable, the statute of limitations is probably the most discussed point. Right now, it's 3 years from the onset of symptoms to when you can file. That was a problem for a lot of these autism cases because the symptoms might not have manifested themselves for a greater period. That needs to be addressed. There's been previous attempts to move it to 6 years, to 8 years. Make it equitable like it is in other federal court systems or even state legal processes where maybe the child up to the age of majority, up to the age of 18, can file. That's one thing there. The other things that are where we get stuck in the weeds on discussions is something that you really can't reform, but what's happening is this, what I call an open season on medical experts, and that is that the intimidation when a petitioner has to bring a claim forward, normally you would want them to go out and find a couple doctors or someone to speak from the medical world on the effects of that vaccine on your child's, what happened there. There's a lot of pressure put on, and I've talked to quite a few medical experts where after they've testified in this process, their employers or the university or their hospital has been contacted and unduly pressure has been put on. So they're going to say, if you continue to testify on the behalf of these girls who have been injured by Gardasil, your research grants are at jeopardy. Things like this. We've even seen on the other side, medical experts who testified on behalf of the government who reversed themselves, they're no longer being called upon, and their employers are being pressured to do something for them. This is the intimidation that's happening. I don't know how to stop, to do that.
How we stop all this is we get independent populist officials elected who will not be motivated by greed, by the vaccine pharmaceutical lobbies to put money into their campaign chest, who really care about injury. We need more articles and we need more documentaries on this topic to make it more more aware. And I thank you for the good work you're doing and your important new book, The Vaccine Court, The Dark Truth of America's Vaccine Injury Compensation Program. Wayne, thank you. And please send me that list of the problems and solutions, and we'll post it on my website, all right?
You got it. Thank you very much, sir.
Wayne Rohde, that's R-O-H-D-E from Minnesota. We're out of time. I want to thank you all for listening, and I look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Now let's say hello to Utrice Lead. Hi, Utrice.
Hello, Gary. Today we pick up the discussion from yesterday, looking at the year 2014. What lessons have we learned and not learned?
Excellent. Utrice Lead right now.